25, please. Father, as we open thy word, teach it to us and make us better because we've been here. Amen. Proverbs 25, and what's the last verse we discussed?
19.
Verse 19, which says, confidence in an unfaithful man in time of trouble is like a broken tooth and as a foot out of joint. And I think we have beside that written what?
Be worthy of trust.
That's number what?
156.
156. And be worthy of trust. Now, the next one that we discuss, and those of you that are here for the first time, we're just going down through the Proverbs and picking out different Proverbs that we think will be helpful. Now, we have entered, by the way, into a different section of Proverbs. We're not going to spend our time telling you about the sections, but I want you to notice that from here on, for at least a couple of chapters, we have a lot of figures of speech mentioned. For example, back up in verse 11, it says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. And verse 12, as an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. Verse 13, as the cold of snow in the time of harvest, so is a faithful messenger to them that send him. You see, we come down to a portion now where things of character are like certain things. We just mentioned in verse 19, confidence in an unfaithful man in a time of trouble is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint. One reason I like this so much is this is the way I preach. I use so many homespun, corny illustrations, you know, and it refreshes me to find that there was another wise man that did this too. His name was Solomon. And think of it now. Who would have thought to say that confidence is like a broken tooth and a foot out of joint? How is that getting the same verse together? A broken tooth and a foot out of joint. I don't know. But we'll find that most of them now, for a series of verses, many verses, deal with figures of speech comparing a certain character trait to certain physical discomforts or comforts or and so forth. So we come now to verse 23 for the next one. The north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry countenance a backbiting tongue. Now, I don't know how it is here, but we always, when it rained where I came from, the rains came from the south and the cold spells came from the north. We called them northers or blue northers, what we called them when the cold spell came. And some of you hillbillies are grinning. You know what I'm talking about, a blue norther. And so when the north wind came, that usually meant a high-pressure area was coming, and not necessarily rain. Rain came from the south, and cold weather came from the north, and so forth. And I think what it means here, as a north wind driveth away rain. Now it's raining, and the north wind comes in. A high-pressure area comes in. And the rain is pushed back by the north wind, and the low pressure area turns back, and the north wind drives it back. Then it compares that to an angry countenance, a backbiting tongue. Now, this does not necessarily mean here that a person that has an angry countenance, you get mad, you'll quit backbiting. It doesn't mean that at all. It means, suppose that you come at me backbiting. You come at me talking critically about someone else. And I give you a dirty look. And I'm not the kind of ground that's fertile for your discussion. You won't keep on discussing it. You see what I mean? That's what it means. Suppose I come to you, Brother Fisk, and I say, I want to tell you something look at somebody out here. I want to tell you something about Mr. Cunningham. I want, Mr. Cunningham is a you know what. And now you smile and say, oh? You see, boy, I've got my head. I'm going to go further into this. I want to tell you. You see, you haven't pushed back the backbiting. But suppose I come and I say, I want to tell you something bad about Mr. Cunningham. And then you, an angry. Yeah. Oh, that's really an angry counter. All right. Well, I'm not going to talk to you. You see, like the wind pushes back the rain, that angry countenance pushed me back, you see. And so what it means here, and write it down. 157, is that right? 157. Write it down, what have I got here? Let me find out what I have written down. Yes, discourage gossip. Discourage gossip. Now, that means about angry countenance. You say, preacher, do you mean God tells us to have an angry look on our face? Sure. Sure. Whoever got the idea that Christians weren't supposed to get mad sold you a wooden nickel. It's not wrong to get mad. Now, it's wrong to get mad at people. And it's wrong to be unkind to people. But the Bible says, be angry and what? Sin not. Doesn't say you sin when you're angry. It says, be careful when you get mad that you don't sin. I wouldn't give you a dime if a fellow couldn't get mad. Why, if you can look at all of the race riots and the lawlessness in America and can't get mad about it, something wrong with you. This kind of a lovey-dovey kind of Christianity that I think you ought to love everybody, but we ought not to love wrong. We ought to hate liquor. Our blood ought to boil every time we see a dirty, lying, cheap advertisement on the television where they teach our boys and girls that they'll be more beautiful in the know if they'll drink liquor, and the girls will be pretty if they'll drink beer, and that you'll be a man of distinction if you'll drink Seagram's 7 and 4 Roses. Why, something inside of you ought to just boil over. But now when you get angry, sin not. What does it mean? It means when I get angry at the liquor, I should not sin against the person who drinks it. You see what I mean? We should be angry and sin not. So get mad. Keep your anger right close to you all the time. Get mad. But when you get mad, be sure you don't get mad at people and be unkind to people. So what he's saying when it says, be angry and sin not, he's saying, go ahead and get mad. But when you get mad, be careful. Don't you do anything wrong. And don't transfer your anger toward people and be unkind to people and hurtful about people. All right? So it means that we should discourage gossip. As the north wind driveth away rain and pushes the rain back, even so our countenance. For example, suppose that I did come for the Fisk and criticize Mr. Cunningham. Do you think Brother Fisk ought to get mad about it? Everybody thinks he ought to get mad, raise your hand. Everybody thinks he ought not to get mad, raise your hand. I'm for those that think he ought to get mad. He ought not to get mad at me, but he ought to get mad at the fact that Mr. Cunningham is being run down. You see what I mean? He loves Mr. Cunningham, and he doesn't want to see him hurt. And so the very thought that the malicious rumor is out about him ought to make Brother Fisk. But he ought not to get mad at me, you see. And so this is the next one. All right. Verse 24 is the next verse, and number 158, right? 158. It is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. Now, I do not know why it says a wide house and a brawling woman. I do not necessarily think that all brawling women are wide. But it implies here that brawling women live in wide houses. So, now, here's what I have written here, and that is just simply this. Ladies, be a loving wife. Be a loving wife. You know, one of the worst things about not being a good wife or a good husband is that you never get another chance to prove what you got. You ever stop and think about that? You buy a lemon from the Chevrolet company, and you can trade it in. Just think about that for a while, and then cry. But really, think about it now, really. If any other possession you have doesn't turn out right, you can get another. But the Bible gives us no way to get another husband or wife except for fornication. That means that if you are not a good wife, that means that not only are you keeping your husband from having a good wife, but you're keeping him from ever having a good wife. Unless he's fortunate and you go on to heaven. Or wherever you're going to go. Now you think about it. That means that if you men do not give your wife a good husband, you'll never have a good husband. Now think about it. That's why it is doubly important that we be good husbands and good wives. And so, let me say, young people, when you marry, young ladies, be a loving, sweet wife. Now, I mean be a good wife. Decide, look, why don't you decide, while you're young, before you get married, that if you're going to be a wife, you'll be just as prepared and trained to be a wife as a doctor would train to be a doctor. It ought to be a profession. A person's going to be a plumber, he learns all about plumbing. A person's going to be a doctor, he studies about medicine. Why is it that we'll enter the marriage altar and take the marriage vows and not even read one book about how to be a good wife or a good husband? Isn't that a foolish, stupid approach to it?
I know, listen, if I were you, young girl, before I marry, I would make a study of the Bible and of every other decent book I could get about being a good wife. And I'd become a good wife like any other profession. The same truth, especially the truth of the wife. Now, a man has a profession, but a wife, usually, her profession is being a wife. And consequently, the Lord puts the burden of the home mostly on the wife. Now, there's a reason for that. A woman has more influence on a man than a man does on a woman. Though the man's the head of the house, I heard a little statement about it, and I can't think about it. But the man is the head of the house. But the wife has tremendous influence on the man. And that means that, and a wife is at home, what? A man's at home during his waking hours. How many of you get home at 6 o'clock at night or after? How many get home at 5:30 or after? 5 or after? How many of you never go to work? I mean, what time do you get home? How many get home after 5 o'clock in the evening? Would you raise your hand? All right, that's most of the fellows here. All right, that means if you go to bed at 10 o'clock, that means you're home 5 hours and take 2 or 3 nights of those for church and activities and so forth. You probably don't average 3 hours a day at home. Where the lady is there, most ladies are there almost every waking hour. That means that the spirit of the home is determined more by the lady than it is the man. Wouldn't that be true? Consequently, God says to the lady that it is your vocation. And it mentions a brawling woman. There is listen, ladies, there's nothing any more unladylike than to be a fussing, nagging, brawling person. God didn't make you to be that way. And one of the reasons is you're not willing to be a lady. You want to run the house. You want to make the decisions. You think that you're inferior to your husband. You're not inferior to your husband. God just made you to have one thing and your husband the other. Well, you say, I've got my rights. Yeah, you got your rights. You also got a right to be a decent wife, too, and let your husband make the decisions around the house. Every town needs a mayor. Every state needs a governor. Every country needs a president or a king. Every company needs a boss or an owner. And every home needs a boss. Somebody's got to be the boss. And in the home, God has made the man the boss. So, ladies, if I were you, I would enter into becoming a wife. I would enter into marriage intelligent. I would read books. Listen carefully. I would read books. I would read everything the Bible says about a home or a wife. I'd get the Cruden's Concordance. And every time I found the word wife or a woman mentioned in the Bible, I would check it. I would read every verse. I'd read Dr. Rice's book on the home. I would read every other book I could get on the home. I'd read Kathy Rice's book, which I think is the best thing you can read apart from the Bible for a good wife. I'd read that. Then I'd get me a book by a good doctor who was not vulgar-minded, but a good doctor that would teach me how to be a wife physically and teach me how to be a wife romantically. I'd read everything I could on how to be a good wife. And when I got married, when I got down this altar and I said, I do, I would consider it the graduation exercises for my course on being a good wife. All right. Let's go down to the next one, verse 25, number 159. All right? 159, okay? As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. Notice we're still using figures of speech. Better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than the brawling woman in the White House. The north wind driveth away rain, so an angry countenance, a backbiting tongue. And now, as cold waters to a thirsty soul. Now, anybody knows what that means. There's not a one of us of what has been thirsty in the hot summertime. Maybe you're out playing ball, or you're taking a walk, or you're on a hike or something, or been riding a bicycle, or been working hard, and you're thirsty, and boy, you see a good, cold drink of water. And it's just frosted over, you know, where you can't quite see, and in the water, and the frost on the outside. And, oh, my, what a wonderful refreshment it is. Now, it also says, like that, is good news from a far country. Now, what this really means is, good people that spread good news and not bad news about other people are like a drink of water on a hot day, a cold drink of water on a hot day. So write down this. Spread good news and not bad. Spread good news and not bad. I guess every preacher has this. But I used to have a fellow in Texas. he'd meet me usually right over here in the hall as I'd come out of the or come out to preach. And he'd heard something. I don't know what he'd heard. But he'd say such things as this: "Preacher, I just want you to know, as you walk out there and fight the fight for God today, I'm with you. I don't care what they say." And I didn't have time to find out what they said. And all the time I was preaching, I said, "Oh, brother, am I going to get fired? Is somebody trying to shoot me? What did they say? What did they say?" Don't you just love people like that? Don't you worry about what they've been saying. Boy, oh boy. And you can't sleep at night and you wonder about it. You're afraid to ask, afraid they'll tell you. And so you suppose things. And those little sunshine spreaders, God decreased their tribe. What it's saying here is, say good things. I wish I could tell you the way I handle the staff sometimes, but I won't go into it. But I don't allow anybody on the staff to bring bad reports to me. I don't want to hear them. You go out visiting, you get dog bit, don't tell me about it. We used to have folks in Texas come back. We used to have one big visitation night because we had a neighborhood church and didn't draw our folks from quite as far as we do here. And folks would come back, and we had two or three people. "Well, we just thank God we was able to do our little part." Said, "We didn't get to do much, except we got dog bit." Well, that really makes folks want to go visit them, doesn't it? And that same crowd get up the next Sunday and testify and said, "I just want to thank God I got dog bit for Jesus." And 200 people will say, "I'm not going to go visit them, brother. I'm not about to do it." So, why don't you be the kind that spreads cheer instead of gloom all the time? You know people, don't you, that you see that make you feel better because they always have good reports and spread sunshine? That's the kind of people all of us ought to be. All right, let's go further. Number 160 is verse 26. A righteous man falling down, circle the word falling and write compromising, before the wicked, circle the word before and write in front of the wicked, is as a muddy, not troubled, but muddy fountain and corrupt spring. Now let's read it with the words changed. A righteous man compromising in front of the wicked is as a muddy fountain and a corrupt spring. What does it mean? It means, and write this down, of 160, it means that a compromiser muddies the water. A compromiser muddies the water. Here's a person that in front of the lost world compromises. Now, let me say a word about compromise. When we think about compromise, we think about drinking a bottle of liquor, don't we? We think about smoking a cigarette. No, sir, that is not compromise. That kind of sinning is unconditional surrender. Fellow said, "Well, take a drink." "No, I'm not going to take a drink. I'm a Christian." "Oh, come on. One drink's not going to hurt you." "No, I'm not going to do it now. I'm a Christian." "Well, the Bible said I shouldn't do it, and the Bible said..." "Oh, come on. Okay, I'll just take one." That's not a compromise. That's an unconditional surrender. Compromise is meeting him halfway. He says, "Take a drink." "No, no." "Oh, come on. Take a drink." "No, I'm not going to do it. Okay, I'll drink one myself." So you sit there at the same table while he's drinking it. That's compromise. Compromise is not necessarily you drinking liquor. Let somebody drink it in the house where you live. And that clouds it up. You say, "Well, how's if I do that, I might win his confidence." No, sir, he's already won you. You see? Right. Now, let me say this. Not only is a Christian not to do that which is wrong, but he is not to compromise. Let's, for example, I ask you with a fist, "Loan me $10. Come on, 10. Come on. Oh, now I've got to have it. Loan me $10. How much would you loan me? 15? How about 750? Keep coming up. How much? $6?
Couple bucks?
$4.50. A deal. You see this? All right. Now, I'm saying that, now that's compromise. You see, compromise is giving in. Now, look, if it is an issue that there's no conviction about, then it's not wrong to compromise. But if there's a convention involved, don't you give 1 inch, not 1 inch. And when you do, here's what you're supposed to do. You cloudy the stream. You muddy the water. You muddle the picture. Folks can't. Then folks look and say, well, what's a Christian supposed to do? That fellow compromised and gave in. What's a Christian supposed to do? And the water's muddy. But as long as you stand firm, then on your convictions, then people can see the clear water and the dark water, and they can see the difference, you see. So I have, don't compromise. Don't compromise is verse 26. Verse 27 is the next one. It is not good to eat much honey. Now we learned the other night you're supposed to what?
Eat honey.
Let me ask you a question. How many of you have started eating honey since the other night? Well, wonderful. Why don't you do all the other things I tell you to do? You ought to eat some honey. But did you know too much honey is not good for you? Now here's what it applies. So for men to search their own glory is not glory. Now it compares seeking self-glory to eating too much honey. We're going to get down to that in a few minutes, a little more about that. But I want you to write down beside verse 27 simply this, never labor for glory. Never labor for glory. I guess all of us have the same old desire in our hearts to get attention and praise. I guess there's not a one of us but what does not want to receive praise. And how many times have you said to yourself or to your husband or wife, nobody really appreciates me? Well, I think that's natural to say that, but it's not right to say it. A lot of things that are natural to say that are not right to say. Never seek for glory. Never seek for glory. You know, God has a wonderful way of giving glory to those who ought to have glory. Let all the glory be given by God. Let others, if they see you merit something, let others give you your due reward, but never seek it for yourself. Never try to get glory for yourself. All right, now I'd like to say more about that, but I'll go on. Verse 28, the next one. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls. Right beside that, be a disciplined person in charge of your own person. Be a disciplined person in charge of yourself or in charge of your own person. Do not let circumstances determine what you do. Let what you do determine the circumstances. Did you know I would not get one-tenth done what I get done if I just let circumstances determine what I do? I live a schedule. For example, today, this morning, I spoke in Springfield, Missouri. I worked as much today for the church here as if I'd been here. I spoke at 9:45. Yes, at 9:45. And then while the next speaker was speaking, I outlined the Sunday school lesson for tonight. And then, the one you got tonight. And then while the closing prayer, now don't you start leaving during the closing prayer, but while the closing prayer was going on, I tiptoed out and found a telephone and called long distance and gave and dictated over the phone machine here the Sunday school lesson for tonight. Now why? That's just what I do. That's the way I live. I determine. And while other people are out sometimes at big meetings or so forth, while other folks are out lounging around in the vestibule, chitting and chatting about how's the family, I'm off in the corner, so I'm supposed to be doing. I've got stuff to do. I've got work to do. And I want to make myself do the work that I ought to do. That's one reason why I don't spend much time playing around with other preachers and so forth. I've got work to do. And so we ought to control ourselves. Well, I just can't help it. I just can't help but do it. Yes, you can help it. You're the kind of person that's in charge of yourself, has control of yourself. I just can't help it. I just fly off the handle, lose my temper, and I can't. Yes, you can help it. Well, you say, how can I help? I can't tell you how you can help it, but I can prove you can help it because you're going to answer to God for it, and God wouldn't make you answer for something if you couldn't help it. You can control your temper. You can control your emotions. Be the kind of person that has control of yourself. All right, let's go further. We're going to skip several verses and go down to verse 11 of chapter 26. Verses 1 through 12, by the way, deal with a fool And then, well, we'll just mention one or two of them. Verse 11, as a dog returneth to his vomit, this is a terrible verse, so a fool returneth to his folly. Now, I'm going to describe this very briefly. I don't want to go into it. But have you noticed the unusual appetites that dogs have? Here's a dog gets sick at his stomach, and then he goes right around and gets it back again. Now, don't go all like in the Bible. I got to preach the Bible. You say, oh, that's not near as sickening to God as some of you folks that do something wrong. You find out dirt doesn't turn out right, you pay for it, go right back in your heart, the old vomit you were in before. You young folks go out, and you act like indecent people, and act like animals, and heathen young people, and you find out it doesn't work. You find out your ends in heartbreak, and you lose what's right and decent. And then you get rid of it. And realize it was as bad as the vomit of a dog. And it looks like you'd have enough sense not to go back and eat it again, doesn't it? That's what it means. What it means. And the way you turned up your nose a while ago when I mentioned that dog going back and eating his own vomit, that's the way God feels about you and me when we don't learn our lessons. That God goes, oh! And so I have beside that one, learn your lesson well. Learn your lesson well. I have mentioned this before, but it's so descriptive. We used to have a little black cat. Mrs. Hiles and I, before we ever went off to college, we had no children, and so we had a little black cat. Cutest little thing you ever saw in your life. And we had in the bathroom, right beside the laboratory, we had a stove, a gas stove, the little kind that we used to have. I don't know whether you see many of them or not, the little enclosed kind, little bathroom gas enclosed stove, kind of you put on the gas jet. And so that little cat, we got the cat, I guess, in the summertime. Anyway, the cat used to get up on the stove and, cutest little thing, and look over into the laboratory while we would wash our face or brush our teeth and so forth. And so wintertime came, and, of course, you know the rest of the story. First time that stove was good and hot, the little cat was used to getting up there on that stove, and so we're washing our face, brushing our teeth, and the old black thing just jumped up on the stove and looked over and jumped halfway up in the room, and oh, the poor little thing hollered and screamed. You know, that little cat wouldn't even come to the bathroom anymore. He'd walk by and he'd look in there and just keep on by. He got more sense than you have. You get burned by sin and then forget about it and go on back and do it again. Dog going back to his own vomit. That cat's got more sense than you and I. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we could learn once and for all that sin's not fun, sin brings tragedy, and doing wrong is not fun. I don't care how much fun it seems for a moment, it's not going to turn out fun. Wouldn't it be good if once and for all, young folks, you could learn that? Just learn it. Anything that God says not to do in the Bible is going to burn you. Now learn it. Don't have it. A man told me, I won't tell you all the story, but a man told me in this building, he's here tonight, I'm sure, he said there was a time in my life when I had $100,000 and I was a young man. He's here tonight. I wish you'd have been here when he had the $100,000. Think of it. He said, you know what I did? He said, I squandered it. I told him, I said, you could put that in the bank and lived off the interest of it the rest of your life. At a regular salary, the rest of your life. If you could invest that in bonds and so forth, you'd have made $7,000 a year the rest of your life, plus some. He said, I was a fool. I was an idiot. And I said, you sure were. You sure were. Isn't it a shame that we won't take the advice and learn from people that have been down the road before? So it says that as a dog returneth to his own vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly. Here's a fella, goes out on Saturday night, he gets drunk as he can be, wobbles down the road, has a car wreck, comes home, money's all gone, Sunday morning, has a hangover, loses all he's got in his stomach, he has to drink hot coffee, black coffee, try to sober him up, he feels terrible, he goes to work with a headache on Monday, what happens the next Saturday? Well, the stupid idiot goes right back to the same old tavern. Dog going back to his vomit. Same thing. Can you understand why folks do such stuff as that? So learn your lesson. Learn it well. All right. Now let's go down to verse 17, please. Verse 17. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife, belonging not to him, is like one that taketh a dog for the ears. In the original language, it says it's like Lyndon Johnson. I think, was he criticized for taking his dog and holding up with the ears? But that's what it says. Now, what does it mean? Write it down, the next number. Tend to your own business. That's what it means. Here's what it says in the original, no joke. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife, which is not his business, is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. That is what you do. You go down the street and see a bulldog there lying asleep, resting in peace. Or better still, see a bulldog fighting with another bulldog. And you be a good Samaritan. You say, I'm going to do my good deed for the day. I'm just going to pull this one off of the other one. Reach out and grab him by the ears. That's the way a person is, always tending somebody else's business. What does it mean? Tend to your own business. That's one reason why I never, never, never try to help a couple that are fussing unless they come to me for help. I never do it. Just as sure as I'm an inch high, they'll both gang up on me. I've seen it happen again and again and again. I learned the hard way. So unless you are, unless your advice is ask, if it's none of your business, don't meddle with it. That's what it says here. If you do, you're like, it's like a fellow picking a dog up by the ears. Verse 20. This is a good verse. Where no wood is, there the fire goeth out. So where there is no tail bearer, the strife ceaseth. As coals are to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. Now I have written with these two verses, don't bring up old wounds. Don't bring up old wounds. If you don't put any more wood on the fire, it'll go out. This summer, Mrs. Howes and I were in Colorado, and we had a fireplace. So I built a fire every night, and it went out the next morning. And so one morning, the fire had been off all day. We hadn't had any warmth all day from the fire. So I had the cute idea that you're supposed to build a fire at night. You know, I'd get the paper just right before I went to bed at night. And put the kindling wood on top of it. You know what kindling wood is? But you know what's going to happen, don't you? You can see it coming. And so I put the kindling wood on top, and the logs on top of that. And I said, now, you got a smart man. I build my fires, and all I've got to do tomorrow morning is, oh, it got cold out there. It got down in the 20s. Summertime. So all I had to do tomorrow morning is just hit the match right quick and get out of bed and
run over there right quick, pack it, light it,
get back in bed, and the fire's okay. But I didn't know that embers could stay there all day long. So I built my fire. It wasn't long till I heard something crackling. And we were in bed, and of course we didn't want to get the place warm. And I had to dig. So I looked over, and we had a fire. It was a whopper. And so I jumped out of bed, and I grab a log out and I pour water, and the water makes smoke all over the room and ashes flying everywhere. I'm trying to put it out. I can't let the thing burn because we'll just smother all night long. And so it gets bigger, and pretty soon I put all of it out, and the smoke, we had to open the windows and we were about to asphyxiate. Now why? If I had left the thing alone, you know, most of us are that way. Did you ever say to your husband, just like you said 24 years ago? Huh? You've always been that way. Look, wouldn't it be a good thing if we had just sort of built a fence and not bring up these old issues all the time? Huh? We never forget, do we? We never forget. Now look, quit putting wood on the fire. Let the fire die out. Just about the time the fire gets died out, we put some more wood on the fire. And so what it says here is, I have it written down here. Let's see. Where am I? What verse am I in? Don't bring up old wounds. I told you, don't bring up old wounds. All right, now down to verse 24, please. He that hateth dissembleth with his lips, or is a hypocrite with his lips, and layeth up deceit within him. Now, when he speaketh fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Now, I have two things written here. One, be sincere in your compliments. And in contrast to that, don't be extravagant with your compliments. I want to talk to you for a minute right here. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Look, be careful that you're always sincere, young people, everybody, in your compliments. Or your compliments won't mean anything. Have you ever known anybody that just walked down the street and said, "Oh, what a beautiful tie, and that handkerchief, and that suit. Aren't those pretty shoes on Brother Fist? And look at those socks on Brother Hand. Boy, look at them. Oh, Brother Hand. And what a nice sport coat Brother Colston has." Oh, nobody. You can become too much honey. The Bible says only too much honey. That kind of person, here's one thing about that kind of person. If they ever don't compliment, you wonder if you're shoddy. Don't you? That's why it is dangerous not to be yourself and to be too friendly when it's not your own friendliness. Because if you're the least bit not antagonistic, but if someday you act like the rest of the world acts, everybody thinks you're mad. That's why a person, I say this really, really advisedly, that's why a person ought to be sincere. A man said to me across the table, and I'm not boasting, because another man said something else too across the table, but a man said to me across the table the other day, he said, I've been preaching for years, I've heard many preachers. He said, "I believe that you're the nearest thing to an open book I ever heard in a preacher." That's what he said. He said, "I believe you honestly are the honest, most honest preacher when you preach." He said, "I think you come as near to really saying what you believe." Now, I consider that a compliment. I did. Here's why I did. Because whenever I say something, he knows I mean what I say. Now, I think we ought to compliment pretty tired, but not everybody's tired. You see. Don't be extravagant with it. I suspicion people that are always peaches and cream. So, don't be extravagant in your compliments. Be sincere in them. Be sincere. Don't ever compliment anybody with any motive at all except you see something you want to compliment. Don't use any ulterior motive. That's one reason. If you're an insurance man or a salesman, it's funny. Did you ever go to a salesman on a car lot? Now, I'm not talking about about Mr. Coffin back here or any other car, or Mr. McKinney or any of the cars. And he said, "Good morning. How are you? Hello there, little fella. Is this your fine little boy? Yeah, well, you're a fine little shaver." And you see the same fella when he's not on the car lot. And you see that as that, there comes that real friendly fella. He says, "Good morning." I sort of suspicion he had no ulterior motive in saying, "You got a fine looking little boy there." Don't you? So consequently, I think it's always a good idea to be sincere in what you say. I think that you ought to be the kind of person that does compliment things, but don't exaggerate it. Don't be extravagant with it. And don't put on. Be sure you're sincere. Be sure that folks will know when you say something that you mean it, and then they'll appreciate it a lot more. All right, let's go further. Down to verse 1 of chapter 27, please. "Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." Now, this verse is used oftentimes in evangelistic-type sermons. A preacher says, "Don't say you'll be here tomorrow because you may die before tomorrow." That's in the verse, but that's not the main teaching of the verse. The main teaching of the verse is don't predict your success. Write it down. Don't predict your success. Don't predict your success. Young people, don't ever say you're going to be the best at anything. Say you're going to do your best to be your best, but not the best. You see what I mean? Young preachers, Don't ever say, I'm going to build the biggest church in Indiana. Don't ever say that. You can say this, I'm going to do my best as a pastor. But don't predict success. Don't ever say what you're going to do tomorrow. Folks can see what you did yesterday. Day after tomorrow, they will have seen what you're going to do tomorrow. Let them see it. Let your work speak for itself. I know a lot of preachers, especially, that boy, as soon as they get to the next place, they're really going to do a great job. Somebody asked me when I came to Hammond, you expect to build a church as great in Hammond as you did in Texas? I said, man, no. Really, I didn't. I said, I don't expect to ever have a church as great as that church in Garland was. Never do. Well, they said, hi, you think you can do it up north? I said, man, I don't know. I'm scared to death. Everybody says you can't do it in the Chicago area. So down south, you can do it. Can't do it up north. I'm scared to death. I would never have said it. Brother, if somebody had said to me that we'd ever had 3,314 in Sunday school, I'd have trembled like a leaf. Don't ever predict your own success. Let your work speak for itself. All right. That's good advice, by the way. That's probably about the best thing you hear tonight. Number two. Verse 2, let another man praise thee, and not thine own mouth, a stranger, not thine own lips. Right down beside that, don't praise yourself. Don't praise yourself. Did you ever hear me tell you about what a good softball pitcher I used to be? Huh? Did you ever hear me tell you how I used to be a semi-professional softball pitcher? Huh? You know why I tell you that? I'm washed up now. I have to tell you, I can't show you. You see? I tried to show, we played the teenage boys one time, a game. The staff played the teenage boys, and I struck out the first six batters, and the next fellow hit a home run. And then they started to hit me all. I can't show you anymore. I'm all washed up. The kind of fellow's always talking about what he does. He usually is washed up. Did you know what I did? I won the contest. Okay, well, let's see what you can do now. The proof of the pudding's in the eating. Don't praise yourself. If praise is due, God will give it to you. But don't praise yourself. Just keep working and keep busy. A lot of folks are so busy talking about what they did yesterday and planning what they're going to do tomorrow, they never do anything today. Never anything today. All right? We'll go down to verse 6 now for the last one for tonight. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. I have down here, be an honest friend. Be an honest friend. I don't have any girlfriends. Could it be that I have bad breath? Now, an honest friend will say, well, Jack, I just want to tell you honestly, you do. You do. And if you'll try Listerine. Oh, I'm tired of all those sweet tasting gargles. But Listerine is different. It's more than a gargle. It's a mouthwash. And it's set to be approved by the American Medical Association. Now, what does it mean? That fellow's your friend. He's your friend. I do not believe in being critical. Look, if you've got something to say that's bad about somebody, why don't you say it in love to them so it'll help them? You see what I mean? Better are the wounds of a real friend than the kisses of an enemy. What does it mean? Every person that is gooey excessively in his compliments and bypasses weaknesses and faults and doesn't try to help another person is a friend of that one who kissed Jesus Christ on the cheek and with the kiss betrayed him. Be the kind of a friend that will constructively speak. If there's something about a person that needs improving that's going to hurt them, tell them kindly and not someone else unkindly. To me, the verse above it says about the same thing. Open rebuke is better than secret love. Open rebuke is better than secret love. how we need to be friends. The kind of friends that can be depended upon. The kind that'll be friends critically, yes, if needs be, kindly and critically. That doesn't mean that everybody you know that does something you don't like, you're supposed to go to them and tell them what it is. Doesn't mean it at all. That means, however, listen carefully. That means if you are more qualified, now hear me, if you are more qualified in a given area, and it is generally accepted that you are more qualified, if you know something that can help someone that is less qualified in that area, and it is considered that they are less qualified in that area, that you owe it to them to try to help them. Now listen carefully again. That doesn't mean you go to everybody. That doesn't mean you go to everybody that you, something you don't like about them, say, I want to tell you something in real loving kindness. No, you be sure you're qualified to be an expert. Let me illustrate. Suppose that I saw with a fist doing something that I think a preacher should not do. But not only that, that would hurt his ministry. Honest to goodness would hurt his ministry. Don't you think to talk to him secretly and privately about that would be a good thing? Do you think I've earned the right to do it? Would you say that in our field, please be on my side, would you say that in our field I have achieved maybe the right to do it? Would you think so? How about if I saw Lee Robertson doing it? You think I ought to say, Dr. Robertson, could I talk to you a few minutes now? There's something I think I'd be cremated, and I shouldn't do it. So I'm not saying that in every case you've got to earn that kind of a right. If you have been a good enough friend by sticking with someone and being their friend through the years, where they'll know you're doing it because you love them, you've earned that right. That doesn't mean everybody that you know, so I believe he's a pretty good friend of mine, I'm going to tell him off. That's not what it means. It means that if you have earned the right to do so, you go to college, you go to high school, go to school tomorrow. You say to the math teacher, now look, you're wrong. You don't know how to teach math. Let me show you something that will help you make a better teacher out of you. You do that? No, sir, you don't do that. But I'll tell you what, the person that taught that teacher how to teach in teacher's training class can say, look, there's something you're doing that's not right, and I want to tell you something to make a better teacher out of you. You see what I mean? They've earned the right to do so. They've earned the right to do so. And so to be the right kind of friend is so important. You say, well, I'd love to have a friend like that. No, sir, be a friend like that. Be the right kind of a friend. A friend that sticketh closer than a brother. Our Father, help us to be the best Christians we can be. Faithful always to being the right kind of people. And we will learn from Proverbs how better to live and associate ourselves with fellow man. In Jesus' name, amen.